Good morning. A warm welcome from the Wilson Center, and welcome to those listening here in Washington, D.C., and a warm welcome to our friends around the world. I'm Roger Mark D'Souza, the Director of Population, Environmental Security and Resilience here at the Wilson Center. And I'm really proud to say that this is our 85th Ground Truth Briefing. This is really an impressive accomplishment for our scholars and fellows who make our work possible. So thank you for joining us today. And today, it continues a series of Ground Truth Briefings that analyze what the world expects of President Trump. Over the last few weeks, we have heard the views from Russia, Africa, India, Israel, Mexico, and Iran. If you've missed those, you can download the podcast at wilsoncenter.org. Today, we're looking at the threat to our national security from climate-related migration. And firstly, I'd like to introduce our fantastic group of speakers. We have Maxine Burkett, who is a professor of international environmental law at the University of Hawaii and a Wilson Center Global Fellow. We also have Joseph Cassidy, who is a Wilson Center Fellow and a former Director of Policy, Regional, and Functional Organizations at the U.S. Department of State. And finally, we have with us Sherry Goodman, who is a Wilson Center Senior Fellow and a former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense at the U.S. Department of Defense. So welcome all. Recently at the Wilson Center, we did an analysis of these issues, looking at the connections between climate, migration, and conflict in a changing world. And this report, called Navigating Complexity, identified conflict from climate-induced migration as being really critical to our national security. We recognize that there are a number of political, social, and economic factors that drive these trends, that they're highly interdependent and complex, and in conjunction with climatic factors can contribute to conflict. Some of the key takeaways from this report is that we have to be very careful when we use the term climate refugee, that according to the United Nations, nearly 75% of migration occurs within borders, while the rest occurs across borders. And if some of this migration is occurring at a communal level, conflicts where climate change and displacement are important can spread beyond these local communities. We also recognize that movement is not inherently negative. In fact, migration can be a peaceful and successful way to achieve climate adaptation. So these are some important conclusions for us. And I'd like to start our discussion today to have a sense of what is an assessment, what is your assessment of the current situation. So Maxine, I'd like to start with you. And I know you wanted to start by defining some of these terms that we use when we talk about these issues. What are your thoughts, Maxine?
That's great. Thanks, Roger Mark. I would love to start with definitions, largely because sort of as a lawyer, you often hear the term climate refugee used to describe the phenomenon that we're experiencing right now. But, of course, the term refugee has a very specific legal definition, and with that, a number of obligations that states are meant to meet for those who are facing some kind of forced migration. In the refugee context, there's no choice to move. It's urgent. It's often in response to political persecution. So what we're talking about here is appropriately called more of a climate-induced migration. And migration can be forced, but oftentimes is a choice which may be made under duress, but is at least deemed to be an opportunity to improve your outcome versus staying in place. Relocation is another term that you may have heard about. Relocation tends to be coordinated. There's planned relocation that cities or national governments will foster in order to get communities out of harm's way, and it's usually in response to five different scenarios of sort of a trigger with respect to climate change. The sudden onset disasters that force movement pretty immediately after some kind of major storm event has happened or some kind of major coastal flooding. The super typhoons, for example, have been instances in which sudden onset disasters have sparked pretty intense and large-scale movement of people. It may be temporary, it may be longer term. There are also slow-onset environmental disasters, environmental degradation, like drought, extreme heat, again, extreme flooding that over time that make it very difficult for communities to live in place, and that also will cause movement. We saw some of that in the case of the Horn of Africa and extended drought in that region. Unrest, violence, conflict over resources, that itself can also spark migration, which may then induce further conflict as communities move from spaces of intense of dissension and in some cases violence. We also have the scenario that you hear a lot about, which is the destruction of small island states, the loss of territory that has sparked a significant, at least conversation in early planning with respect to moving entire nation states, people from their current territory, which has been discussed in Kiribati, in Tuvalu, in places like the Republic of the Marshall Islands here in the Pacific. And then finally, there's that scenario of planned relocation. In the Mekong Delta, for example, the governments there are looking at coordinated relocation of communities that are in more precarious positions as a result of the change in climate. And what's really important to understand with respect to climate, migration, conflict is that oftentimes uncertainty about your security, about your future, is one of the most critical factors that can lead to violent conflict. And it could be perceived insecurity in some cases that is actually more difficult than the actual security risks. But of course, we know as the climate continues to change that those risks are becoming more and more palpable. We also know that it's this kind of migration and relocation is happening in our country, in communities, indigenous communities, primarily in Alaska, in Louisiana, coastal Washington. We see it in the Pacific Islands again, in the Carteret Islands. We know that the poorest of the poor, the most vulnerable, are the most severely affected. They actually are usually unable to leave. These are called trapped populations. We know that an individual's or a community's ability to adapt to environmental change may be a greater determinant of their migration than a particular sudden or slow onset event. So in some respects, you can avoid these outcomes if you are better prepared to adapt to the consequences of climate change.
Thank you very much, Maxine. So Joe, I wonder if I could turn to you now and ask for your thoughts, sort of building on some of the key points that Maxine has raised about displacement, relocation, movement. She talked about a number of areas of the world where we know this is a pressing concern. You spend a lot of time at the State Department. How do you see these connections?
Sure. Thank you, Roger Mark. Good morning, everybody. Aloha, Maxine, out in Hawaii. What I thought I'd do at the start is to unpack a little bit about the different categories of risks associated with climate-induced migration. So first category, direct costs. There will be greater costs for border enforcement efforts, so law enforcement agencies, barriers potentially, Coast Guard cutters working the Mediterranean and the Caribbean. Financial costs associated with increased demand for humanitarian assistance as people around the globe. So those direct costs are sort of easy to see. The second category of things that we need to be cognizant of are the indirect costs. So one good example is terrorist groups using mass migrations as a cover to infiltrate the United States or our allies. Those same terrorist groups using mass migrations as a revenue stream as they go, as they get involved in migrant smuggling. There's obviously lots of potential for damage to the global economy, including through trade distortion and worker underproductivity. And then to give you an example of an indirect cost that's a little bit more esoteric, and it's something that Maxine and I have discussed in the past, which is the damage to our multilateral efforts, our diplomatic efforts at the UN and other big international organizations, if there are certain low-lying small island states that blink out of existence over the next 100 years. So God forbid they do, but if they do, one of the consequences that is not sort of much foreseen right now will be to our diplomatic efforts internationally. So that's direct costs, indirect costs. And then the third order, and I think in some ways the most interesting category of risks for national security for climate-induced migration, are these risks that come from the way we respond. So this can include if there is increased conflict because of global climate change or migration spawned by it, that conflict can either draw on the U.S. military or stress it. That's something I'll leave to Sherry because she's the expert on that, but it's one of the aspects of that. There are potential reputational costs to the United States and the brand of America regarding our border enforcement activities, for example. There are potential risks to social stability in the United States and in our allies. Roger Mark, as you know, we did a podcast a couple months ago with Diana, and we talked about the potential for democratic societies to sustain large amounts of social change in short time frames, and obviously this instability that we're seeing in Europe right now, and I would argue in North America, has something to do with these large-scale social changes. So really what we're talking about in those third-order risks are people and governments making poor choices under stress and that have unintended consequences. And to give you a real-world example right now, so as you know, Roger Mark, I've been critical of the Trump administration's executive order on visas and refugees. And one of the unintended consequences, I think, for how that order was designed and rolled out was that the visa restrictions have undermined the position of our technology companies and our universities. It's had an effect on tourism already, and there's certain reputational costs. So those are sort of third-order risks that I think are important to think about. And the other thing I'll say in this sort of intro speech is to address the U.S. government's ability to handle this. And I think there are ways that the U.S. government is structured that don't automatically help us think in long-term strategic ways. So, for example, again, this is something that that Sherry knows because from her time at the Defense Department, but the National Security Council itself tends to skew toward hard power. For senior officials, it's what's visible to them, it's what's available to them. The State Department is relatively disempowered. I think folks may be aware that over the last couple of days there have been press reports that the Trump administration may seek substantial budget cuts to the State Department. I think that's going to further that disempowerment of the civilian side of national security. And I think it's also true that, you know, we're at a moment in the United States when there's general antipathy toward foreign aid and hazard mitigation and resilience efforts, the kind of things that we might otherwise do to prepare for this. But those things look a lot like nation building. And as you know, nation building is not much the fashion right now. So I think there are lots of smart people in government that realize that this is, realize the risks involved and realize that we should be doing things now to prepare for those. But the way our system, the interagency system, is structured is not automatically going to help us do that. So, and I think we later in the call we can talk about the structure of the international system, but I think I'll close there and turn it over to Sherry.
Great. Thank you very much, Joe. I think it's very good for us to think about both the direct and indirect costs, but also what it means in terms of these third-order risks. So, Sherry, Joe has specifically talked about the draw on the U.S. military. Could you tell us a little bit more from your perspective, what do you see as the security dimensions of these issues?
Thank you, Roger Mark, and welcome to all our listeners this morning. The U.S. Department of Defense has for over 5 years now recognized climate change as a threat multiplier for instability in fragile regions of the world, and also for a forcing function to affect also stable, we now find stable regions of the world as well. And we see the impacts already in significant ways. Secretary Mattis himself has called out climate change as a force for global instability and one that needs to be addressed in military planning and response. Let me quickly spell out five ways that climate-induced migration is affecting the U.S. military and our ability to deploy forces. First, we've seen over the last decade an increased what we call demand signal to respond to extreme weather events by our forces in the form of humanitarian assistance and disaster relief when major storms strike, tsunamis in Asia, extreme weather events throughout the world. And that means that our military, which is the 911 force for relief, is called more often to provide hospital ships, logistics, other civilian-like relief because they're the ones that can get there first in the event. Second, we see increased instability in countries and regions of key strategic interest to the United States, from the Middle East to South Asia. We now know that long-term climate-induced drought in both Darfur and in Syria have are underlying causes, not the only but an important contributing cause to the conflicts there that have embroiled our troops now for over a decade in various ways, whether as advisors or direct action. Third, we find now that climate change is increasing the need to have forward presence in whole new regions. Take the Arctic, Exhibit A. We now need to have icebreakers in the Arctic that we didn't need before. We need maritime and domain awareness. We need to be present in an ocean that was previously frozen. Fourth, climate change is also affecting the ability of our key military installations to provide readiness for our forces, from Norfolk to San Diego to Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, combination of sea level rise, storm surge, soil erosion, particularly in the East Coast, is degrading our ability to provide the infrastructure needed and the support capability. We already have sunny day flooding regularly affecting our military installations in the Norfolk Hampton Roads region, making it difficult for people to get to work. And finally, if this affects our troops when they deploy and when they train. With warmer weather and warmer temperatures, we have more black flag days, which are days above 90 degrees where our troops are not permitted to train. So it limits the readiness of our force.
Wow, thank you, Shay. That is, I think, very compelling and very comprehensive. Maxine, I wonder about your reflections as you listen to what Sherry and Joe have shared with us. And Sherry talks about increased stability in key areas of the world that are important for our national security. I wonder whether you could talk a little bit more, and you did allude to some of these in your introductory remarks. Where do you see these global hotspots emerging that we in the United States need to pay attention to from a national security perspective?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number. In fact, as we were talking, I was thinking about the fact that we don't really have a full grasp on the exact number of people that we might anticipate moving and what the knock-on effects would be with respect to conflict and violence. But, of course, we are concerned about regions that already have very dense populations. Southeast Asia and South Asia are often understood as very critical areas for potential conflict. Similarly, in the sort of former Soviet Union, there are areas where there are the glacial melt, in particular, is causing there to be increased resource conflict on top of ethnic divides. So we're seeing some tensions around rivers and conflict in the Fergana Valley, for example. We are also seeing similar kinds of events happening in South America. And with respect to glacial melt as well. So the water availability is causing conflict just purely based on the fact that we're seeing an unstable availability of fresh water and uncertainty about what that will look like over time. And as communities then live under that uncertainty, it then sparks the kinds of underlying, or at least worsens the kinds of underlying ethnic divides that have been existing. So that's going to be really critical. When we're thinking as well about what is happening in the Sahel region, that I think has been long known, that's been mentioned with respect to Darfur, and it is really important that we have a clear eye on how much of this is sort of poor governance and how much of it is actually climate. But it is definitely true that the combination of the two create for much more sort of difficult planning in those regions. And just to sort of get back to the numbers game here, we have a clear understanding that if we get a better sense of the scope of the issue, we can at least plan for it. But right now, we don't even exactly know how many individuals, communities are going to be affected. We've seen ranges from 25 million people by 2050 to 1 billion. And that's a factor of 40, which makes it also very difficult for us to scenario plan in an effective way as we try to address the potential migration of entire communities. And we know that it does not have to be a very a major sort of increase in temperature to see very extreme movements of people poleward.
Thank you, Maxine. I think an important reminder for us to think about how we deal with the uncertainty. And I would say a reminder for our audience, please press star 1 on your telephone to get in the queue to ask a question, and you can do this at any time during the call. So, Joe, I wanted to get back to some of your comments. You know, Maxine makes the point that it's important for us to do scenario planning. I was quite intrigued in your initial comments. You talked about the indirect costs, and you mentioned trade, multilateral positioning, and sort of issues or risks from a diplomatic point of view. You also teased us a little bit and said you'll talk about the international order. So why don't you talk about that now?
Okay, absolutely. So, and I'm going to be saying things that that both Maxine and Sherry have worked on, so they feel free to jump in. But just to say some things that we sort of all know, but all feed into what I think is my general judgment, that the structure of the international community is also not necessarily going to help us deal with these issues in a strategic way. So we live in this Westphalian world. States are the primary actors in the international system, and they have geographically discrete sovereignty claims. So among other things, they will be differentially affected by both climate change and climate change migration. That leads into lots of collective action problems internationally. There's also no global governance structure that's analogous to domestic governance. There's no sheriff in town. The other thing I would say is multilateral organizations are not currently constructed to deal with this issue, this sort of cross-cutting nexus of issues. So we've got organizations that do security, UN Security Council, you know, Interpol, things like that. We've got organizations that do climate change, Framework Convention, UNEP, IPCC, and we've got all the humanitarian and refugee and migration organizations like UNHCR and IOM and OCHA and the Red Cross, Red Crescent Movement and World Food Program, all those guys. But what we don't have is, so we have a number of organizations that are going to be looking at this particular problem from their particular parochial organizational perspective, and it's not clear to me that we've done enough work sort of intellectually or organizationally to make sure that we've got organizations wrestling with this new potential problem. So something that Maxine knows well, and she and I have talked about in the past, but there's some reason to believe that the international legal regimes are sort of old and creaky and a little bit outdated. So in terms of legal responsibilities, there's probably some additional work that smart people like Maxine can do. And just to say something obvious at the end, there, because of the state of the world, because of the very different degrees of development and safety around the world, migrants will still find huge incentives to do things that are otherwise unsafe. And that will be accentuated in a world where some countries are more affected by climate change or climate change-induced migration than others. So there's still going to be a very strong pull factor. And to wrap this up, Roger Mark, as you know, one of the things I spend a lot of time on is critiquing the international community's ability to deal with the refugee crisis right now. There, Maxine gave you a sense of the numbers of people potentially affected by climate-induced migration, and they're orders of magnitude different than what we're dealing with right now, and we're not doing a good job right now. So we've got 65 million displaced people in the world. We're struggling right now to provide basic humanitarian assistance in most of those cases, and we're certainly not solving the long-term problems that have forced a lot of them to move. So I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make sure the structure of the international system is conducive to smart strategic decisions.
Thank you very much, Joe. I think the legal framework is one that is really important that we need to continue to pay attention to. Sherry, I wanted to ask you to think a little bit more about the five ways that you say the military is being affected by these trends. You know, I appreciate that you say the military is the 911 force for relief, and I wonder how this will play out under President Trump. You know, he and his administration is certainly vested in ensuring our national security. What are your thoughts on this scenario, on these connections with the Trump administration? Do you see them being able to support addressing these issues, given these the five ways that we see these issues serving as a threat multiplier?
That's a great question, Roger Mark, and I wish I had a crystal ball. I will say that I do believe Secretary Mattis is a strategic thinker, and he, given his druthers, would take a strategic approach to thinking about the risks and the threats that the United States faces and how to harness the right set of diplomatic, development, defense, economic, environmental, and other levers of American power properly to position ourselves within the global international system, which the U.S. built after World War II and which has served us so well. We wouldn't be here without our allies. As Secretary Mattis said not long ago, if I don't have the State Department, I have to buy more ammunition. So I don't think that's where, I think the Defense Department wants to be a team player with the rest of the national security and homeland security agencies. And that requires a comprehensive approach to thinking through both how we approach the crises of the inbox, as Joe referred to. What is that extreme weather event, that next tsunami storm that's bearing down on us, or that next terrorist event that we have to prevent? We have to do that in today's inbox, but we also have to be able to think ahead and think strategically about how to position American diplomacy, American defense, and as well as the full capabilities of American power in order to successfully position the U.S. As well as the world for the future. And that requires a kind of strategic thinking that doesn't say, well, we can just, the mob at the gates, the wall is going to protect us and we'll insulate ourselves. We know that, we do live in a globally interconnected world, even when that has challenges and risks. And we need to address those within our own country, but we also have to provide the tools and resources, civilian and military, to empower our citizens and others to thrive in this type of global environment.
Thank you, Sherry. Maxine, I wondered, as you think about the president's inbox, so Sherry has made the case for U.S. diplomacy and defense and American power and the importance of strategic thinking. And I was quite struck that in your initial comments, you made the case that when we look at this internationally, we know that it's happening globally, but it's also happening within our country. This is both a U.S. problem and an international problem. So as the president is called upon to address these issues domestically within our borders and internationally, and how those two mix, there are questions on the legal parameters. And I wonder whether you could touch on that a little bit. These questions of movement and displacement and relocation affecting us within our borders internationally and connecting the both. What do you see as opportunities on the legal side that you think our president needs to be cognizant of and that his advisors should be looking to?
Yeah, that's also a really great question. What's interesting about the notion of opportunity is that opportunities often arise in these moments of crisis, obviously, and in the sort of absence of a legal framework. And I will say it's going to look very different between the sort of the domestic questions that we ask here in the U.S. than when we look at the international regime. And to quickly touch on the domestic issues, I mean, what we're seeing is that there have been attempts to relocate by communities for a decade and a half, particularly in Alaska, which has been at the forefront of this. And it happens even if the U.S. government is not paying attention to it. And the disadvantage, of course, is that the costs are not fully met. Coordinated responses are always optimal. We do need, the Army Corps of Engineers, for example, to be a key part of the process of moving safely to more sound locations, so the process of making the decision to leave, the transitional period, making sure that the town that you're leaving is viable until all have been relocated. And then, of course, identifying a place that can sustain the infrastructure that you hope to build over time for longevity. So there are ways in which we can see that there is sort of a multi-layer, a vertical approach in terms of governance that we would want to have that would ensure optimal relocation. Similarly, in the Delta region of Louisiana, if we do this without state cooperation, local cooperation, and federal support, it's suboptimal in terms of the responses. And, of course, in more crowded areas, you're going to find there's a higher potential for a softer kind of conflict, but conflict nonetheless, as communities have to move to into other communities or in close proximity to communities that perhaps had more open space or a different demographic composition. So it's complicated in that way. Internationally, I mean, what we're dealing with is the fact that there are very few clear legal avenues, but the spheres of governance and related institutions are many. And so you have, just in the context of certainly cross-border migration, but even as we're dealing with the predominant place where migration will happen, which is within borders, if you're talking about places that have adaptive capacity concerns, governance concerns, international development law, human rights and humanitarian law, refugee law, these will all be in some ways implicated. And again, there are different institutions that are involved. There are also domestic laws that you'll have to probably bump up against, property, immigration, national security, as we're talking about, environmental laws. And then there's hybrid laws like migration and asylum law, indigenous rights, climate, the climate law regime itself. There are just so many areas of law. In some ways, it becomes what a colleague in the environmental law field has described as a regulatory commons problem, which is that it could be owned by so many areas of law that, in fact, it becomes difficult to address it with any.
That's fascinating, this idea of a regulatory commons problem. Just as a reminder to our audience, please press *1 on your telephone to get in the queue. If you have a question, you can do this at any time. So, Joe, I was quite struck when you talked about the third-order risks. You mentioned people and governments making poor choices under stress. There's a lot of stress. Yet Maxine has made the point of that it's really difficult to do any scenario planning. There are a lot of unknowns. So I wanted to ask you and Sherry to talk a little bit more about what is the role of the State Department? What role should the State Department be playing in this context? It's difficult to plan. There are a lot of unknowns. There's a lot of stress. And what role should the military be playing as we think about how to manage this in a way that continues to be in our interests globally? So let me start with you and then Cherry.
Yeah, absolutely. Although let me start by strongly associating myself with something that Sherry said a little while ago, which is the importance of civilian military cooperation, specifically state DOD. So, there's an inequity of capabilities there, but state does have a lot of things to offer, and one of the things that it can do, if properly designed and led, is think about these strategic issues, bring lots of different national interests together, and make smart policy. So as Sherry and I both know and agree, there's been this long line of defense secretaries who have argued that state not be so disempowered in the system, that there needs to be this cooperation. So I think that's important. And I think there are ways that we could do that without spending a huge amount of money. So to give you one example, I'm critical of the NSC system in some ways. One of the things that happens at the beginning of big policy meetings at the NSC is the brief will be led by somebody from the intelligence community. This was the practice under the Obama administration too, so it's been there for a while. But as you imagine, as you can imagine, the folks who conduct that initial briefing set the course of the debate and set the frame of reference for the decision. And the intelligence community, and I've worked with them very closely throughout my career and love and respect them, but they occupy just part of the space when we deal with foreign policy issues. So they have, because of the sources of information that they most focus on, they too have a worldview that's not complete. And I think it's really important in those meetings, especially when talking about strategic issues like this that are complicated and messy and involve lots of U.S. national interests, that we have voices that can talk about all of the interests at stake. So part of it is just there are some small fixes at the NSC system that could help. But one of the big problems, and this goes back to something Sherry said too, which I very much agree with, the big problem for senior policymakers is their incentives are to deal with the crises. It's what the press is asking about. It's what our embassies abroad or military commanders abroad, they're demanding guidance. There are all these demand signals from crises in a way that's not true of these slow onset disasters. And so part of it is just for senior policymakers at the White House and at state and at DOD to be disciplined enough to make sure that they protect the space so that they can think big thoughts. I hope Secretary Tillerson is doing this. I believe that he is. I mean, he's brought lots of experience to the Secretary of State job, managed one of the world's biggest companies. But the risk will always be for senior officials that they gravitate toward those crises because there's all the demand signals are coming through on those. And for something like climate change or climate change-induced migration, people need to think strategically and long-term, and that's often incompatible with the way the system is set up right now.
So Joe, I've heard you in the past talk about distracted elites in the West. Is this what you mean by distracted elites? They're responding to these crisis signals?
It is, definitely. I mean, that you've been in Washington for a while. You've heard this story. People focus on the urgent and not the important. But it's really a problem. And there's no, there's not necessarily magical organizational fixes. It's just the hard discipline of setting aside enough of your staff or enough of your personal senior policymaker time to think about these issues that are not on fire.
Great. So we're going to get to some audience questions shortly, but Cherry, the role of the military?
Thank you, Roger Mark. Well, a former commander of U.S. Forces in the Pacific who has spoken here at the Wilson Center, Admiral Locklear, called climate change among the most serious challenges he faced in the Asia-Pacific region. That's no less true today than it was approximately 5 years ago when he made that statement. Where the military and the diplomatic community can and should be, along with others, working together, and I would say including organizations like the Wilson Center and other think tanks, is to look at those scenarios, those plans. How is this going to play out? How is the U.S. going to be able to respond to multiple extreme weather events occurring around the world at the same time? A tsunami, another major storm in Asia, perhaps one in the Middle East or Latin America, in our own country at the same time, where our own military and guard have had to deploy in response to disasters in the Gulf, along the Atlantic coast, Superstorm Sandy. So we see that these, and we now have the greatest migration, we're living in an era of the greatest migration since World War II.
Yeah.
So we need to be looking and we need to be doing scenario planning and simulations, whether they're done, they're often done within the U.S. military with the rest, with the State Department and with others. If those are not going to be done forward-looking as much in this era, I think that creates a need for it to be done using other resources that are available. I've participated and been part of, as I know the Wilson Center has over the last decade, in simulations on climate security,
yeah,
on water security, on food security. And we're going to need to drill down to specific cases, specific events, projecting into the future how events might play out and how to position capability, whether in the Arctic, in the U.S., globally, to be able to respond either over a period of days, months, weeks, and a year. That's just responsible planning. We all do that for our own financial futures at home. We look at what future scenarios are and we plan accordingly. We need to factor in these set of realities that are facing us as we develop our national security strategy, policy, and plans.
Thank you very much, Cherry. So I'd like to go to some questions that we have queued up, and I'd like to call on Rebecca Ellison from the University of Maryland. So, Rebecca, what's your question?
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call and for this absolutely amazing panel. I have actually a two-part question. One has to do with climate change mitigation and what is being done to help communities around learning how to mitigate some of the effects of climate change. And the second one is probably a little more complicated, but it has to do with I've read some studies around in communities being able to survive some of the negative effects of climate change and basic education levels, investments in primary and secondary education, in particular for girls and women, seems to go a long way in helping them being able to adapt more effectively to the effects of climate change. And I'm curious to know whether anyone on this panel has seen any correlation or not.
Great. Thank you very much. Maxine, would you like to talk a little bit about communities and mitigating the impacts of climate change?
Sure. I mean, you know, this is a critical issue. Obviously, we want to get to the point where we can reduce the amount of people that are in the position that they have to move. And as mentioned earlier, in some ways, migration itself is an indication of a failure to fully sort of adapt to the circumstances at hand. In some cases, you can't. The climate impact will be just so grave, and this is the kinds of situations you see with respect to desertification, for example. You cannot stay. But in many cases, there may be adaptive measures that allow you to at least forestall the need to move, and that's certainly of as much interest to, for example, the Pacific Island nations, who are very much thinking about the now as much as they are aware of the fact that they may have to leave their territory in a generation or two. I was also sort of thinking about the various efforts to understand mitigation and adaptation as a very big part of what what the State Department and USAID do as well. So I'll defer to Joe, actually, on some of those issues, because it is very important to understand that we are also very much supporting communities globally in their efforts to be more resilient to the impacts of climate change, which, again, may allow for a longer ability to stay in place. It's also really important to think about some of the work that's been done on positive peace. And the Institute for Economics and Peace has some really interesting literature with respect to the profile of communities that have been able to affect peace-building efforts. They are themselves more resilient communities. So in some ways, a lot of the work also happens in the front end with respect to education, community processes of decision-making. Again, the sort of these are the inputs for adaptive capacity that allow for greater resilience to the impacts of climate change.
Joel, Sherry?
Sure, just a quick note. Rebecca, thanks very much for the questions. I think you're right on, especially in endorsing the utility of education, especially for women in terms of creating more resilient, more successful communities. And to go to Maxine's point, thanks for the referral. I'll take it up, but I'll use a word that's used a lot in Washington right now, and maybe people are tiring of hearing it, but it's resilience, and it's what we're talking about is creating conditions in countries that are potential countries of origin for mass migrations, and making sure that we're doing what we can to limit those forced migrations anyway. And just to go back to something I said before, I've got a musical interlude. I think we need to be focused more than we are right now on conditions in those countries of potential origin for mass migration. I know nation building is out of favor, but really what we're talking about is the same sort of thing, building institutions, building stronger communities so that they're going to be more successful. I think if you look at the Syria experience over the last half dozen years, we can see the direct connection between the instability in Western Europe right now caused by these mass migrations and the lack of an effective policy to deal with the core problems. I think we're going to see the same thing with climate change, that if we don't make sure our communities are strong, we're more likely to be affected by the displacements. And again, to go back to the press reports that the State Department budget may be cut 40%, that's going to limit our ability to do programming.
Great. And I would say, Rebecca, the question on girls' education is a really important one. There are a number of initiatives in Madagascar, Ethiopia, the Philippines, around the Lake Victoria that are really investing in girls' education as a way of developing women's empowerment and making them more climate resilient. Those are featured on our blog platform here at the Wilson Center at newsecuritybeat.org. So we wanted to go next to Mike McCracken at the Climate Institute. Mike, what's your question?
Thank you very much. My question wants to sort of look ahead 50 years. If I were sort of in charge of the planet and I had to worry about moving a billion people, and if you sort of read the World Bank reports about what the world looks like at 4 degrees, that might be something that has to happen. The big open space in the world that's poleward is Russia. And I guess I'm wondering if there's any thought about having to go to sort of world government thinking about redistribution of people rather than whether the set of countries we have now can really absorb them given the systems they have. I mean, if all the countries are struggling with the flows we're having now, can one really expect to handle that many people? Or does one have to think much more broadly about open space and where one might relocate people?
Great question. Sherry, what do you think?
Well, Mike, thank you for the question, and I think that's why it's always important to do not just short-term scenario planning simulation and exercises, but also to be looking out to different futures. Strategic foresight is very important, and it's done perhaps not often enough. And we do need to look into futures that seem well beyond our imagination today, but ones that we know we've all lived through periods of disruption where, you know, September 12th, September 11th didn't look like September 10th. And so we need to imagine those futures. And you're right, when we think about the displacement of major populations from low-lying coastal areas into regions that will be or could be more, at least temperature-wise, more hospitable in the future. You know, there are vast regions of Russia and other countries that are less developed and, at this point, less populated. The Arctic is a region I think we're going to see change dramatically even in our own lifetimes. And so I think we need to account for that. We need to be able to look at both legal regimes. As a lawyer, I would say I agree completely that our legal regimes for addressing both refugees and migration flows are antiquated at this point. And so we need to think creatively. We need to account for the most vulnerable populations, and we need to anticipate how to enable more communities and individuals to thrive in circumstances beyond which we might ordinarily envision today. So it's a good question. Very good question, and I look forward to tackling this with you and others in the future.
Thank you very much, Sherry. So we have a question from Terry Thompson of LMI.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for a very productive discussion. So in the Navigating Complexity report, and also mentioned at several junctures in this morning's discussion, the need for better data regarding local risks and how they interact with political, social, economic, and demographic factors has come up. My question is essentially, what type of better data would you like to have? And are you concerned about being able to pinpoint for different regions of the world climate risk of different types, specifically through time? That's the question.
Great, thank you. Maxine, any thoughts on better data?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we are, I think, in a very interesting space where we have an incredible amount of uncertainty. And of course, not to say that this isn't happening. This is happening, and certainly the correlation is established, and the causal links I think are being established more clearly in many instances that link, you know, climate, migration, and conflict. What we're finding, of course, is that it is intensely local, and so a lot of the data that we need is really going to be dependent on understanding how certain communities and impacts to ecosystem services are being impacted over time. So a perfect example of that, and actually one that is really important as we think about the current budget scenario, is that we don't understand necessarily how climate is fully impacting ecosystem services, for example, in the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and in fact, what then we know about how that's triggering migration to the United States. I'm currently conducting research right now that's trying to understand where the climate signal is and use that information to see if there's some sort of predictive value there so that we can say in, you know, sort of 10 years, 20 years, 30 years where we might see the intensity of flows. We see people moving from outer atolls, for example, to the main metropolitan center, and then from there through the Compact of Free Association to Hawaii. But that's funded by funding from NOAA and from Interior. And that kind of research is going to be really important over time for us to understand also what the flows look like into the United States and affiliated Pacific Islands, for example. So I think we need to be very sort of aware of what the risks are there. I agree that there is an incredible amount of sort of local impact here that will need to be drilled down to throughout the globe, but it's also true that we will have to be able to operate under uncertainty and understand what we will be risking if we don't act. Again, sometimes perceived insecurity can be much more difficult, and so as we plan, we need to be sure to understand the specific community dimensions and whether or not they are able to adapt appropriately. I will also just sort of piggyback and say there are global efforts, for example, to think about where to take people, and this is sort of harkening back to the earlier question. And when we think about how we could coordinate on an international level, you know, climate change first came up to the Security Council over 10 years ago as a potential security issue. It has been knocked around in sort of the sustainable development world, but has most of its sort of its life and spirit running through the Framework Convention process, which itself has been hobbled to some degree. But in the Paris Agreement, the Paris decision included paragraph 50, which was a call to actually coordinate at an international level on climate displacement. And what was initially a sort of a full-blown facility that would help both local communities determine their risk and get better data, all the way up to trying to have a global conversation of how to potentially manage and coordinate and have cooperation in the flows of people and the relocation that might happen. That then became what's now a task force through paragraph 50 that's looking at some of the impacts, that's looking to work with civil society, but doesn't necessarily have sort of the strength of a full commitment that would have been in the full Paris Agreement. So that's a space that we need to be looking at for both the local to the international arena in terms of decision-making and better planning and better information gathering.
Thank you, Maxine. We have just a couple minutes left, and we have two questions, so we'll try to take these quickly. Katie Smith from Search a Common Ground.
Yes, thank you so much for this panel. I really appreciate the points that made, specifically those by Joseph about incentivizing senior officials to respond to slow burn, non-crisis situations, and Maxine's characterization about resource conflicts playing out over lines of ethnic tension. And I think we see these points coming together in places like Nigeria and the farmer herder violence there. My question is, I wonder in this time where we're likely to see large cuts in the State Department budgets and others, and some reluctance to address climate change directly. How are we supposed to build this kind of this incentive for senior officials to address climate-based conflicts and issues or violence instead of just mitigating the consequences of that violence?
Great, thank you. We'll take one more question and then we'll do a final response. So Sue Jung, who is a fellow at the Wilson Center.
Hello, my name is Yun Jung Yu, a junior scholar in HAPP in the Wilson Center. And thank you for the very useful talks. Well, in the case of refugee, the definition of their status is very critical. And Mr. Cassidy used the term humanitarian refugee for climate-related refugees. So I'd like to ask you that, do you think climate-caused refugees can be regarded as traditional refugees based on the Refugee Convention? I think the Refugee Convention is the most well-known legal framework in the case of refugee. So, yeah, if they are persecuted due to reasons written in the convention, they could be defined as traditional refugees. So, do you consider the climate-related forced migration as a new concept emerged in this era beyond the convention? Yeah, thank
Great.
You.
Great. Thank you very much. So we have just a minute left. So, Maxine, we'll come to you, then Joe, then Cherry. So a question on how do we deal with climate displacement in the context of refugees and looking at traditional refugees and the impact of large cuts in the State Department budget, how do you incentivize action in that context? So, Maxine, any quick reactions from you?
Yeah, I will just say very quickly that, you know, sort of an old adage, an ounce of prevention, this is really massive here, and we've seen this play out over time, that if you act in advance, that certainly allows for less trauma and conflict later on. And I'll have Joe and Sherry speak to some of the details there. I just want to quickly say that the Refugee Convention, unfortunately, is not a place to look to sort of the best path forward in terms of how we might address climate migrants. I think it's a different category, and the absence of persecution, the absence of clear understandings of the persecution or the difficulties occurring because of one's status is a big hurdle. Also, in many cases, the host country, the home country, is actually acting or wants to act to the benefit of their people and their citizens, but is unable to because of the climate. So this is a whole new beast, and of course, the rate of change with respect to climate is increasing itself. So it's a different kind of trigger for which I think we need a different kind of global governance.
Thank you. Joe?
Yeah, very quickly. Maxine and I have talked enough that I would never, ever use the word climate refugee, which she would tell me is incorrect. just to add on to what she said, there's also the other risk with using the Refugee Convention as the locus of international law on this new issue is that most folks in the humanitarian world believe that reopening the Refugee Convention right now would result in a diminution of the protections and responsibilities that are built into the 51 Convention, so people are petrified about doing that. And then finally, just on budgets, agree completely with the question about that we need to make sure that we protect the budget to deal with these long-term prevention issues. And what I'm hoping is that there will be a coalition of people who care about solving these long-term problems that will rise up and make strong arguments that are compelling to the administration and to Congress about why the work that the State Department does on a daily basis on these long-range issues is important and should be funded.
Great. Thank you. Sherry?
Well, in response to the last couple of questions, I think we need to continue to increase our predictive capability in this area. There's been work in the last few years to develop an environmental prediction information system. NOAA has advanced its work on a drought information system that is harnessing a lot of types and of data that hasn't previously been available or been accumulated and used in the same way. There are other systems throughout the public and private sectors that give us now a greater ability to understand weather out beyond 7 days and more towards a couple of weeks and eventually a couple of months. And that type of capability is going to be essential as we seek to plan and prepare for different futures.
Great. Thank you very much. We've had a very rich discussion today, and this set of issues are issues that we continue to work on here at the Wilson Center. So please have a look at our website, wilsoncenter.org, for continuous updates on our work. I'd like to thank Maxine Burkett, a professor of international environmental law at the University of Hawaii and a Wilson Center Global Fellow, Joseph Cassidy, Wilson Center Fellow, and former Director of Policy, Regional and Functional Organizations at the U.S. Department of State, and Sherry Goodman, a Wilson Center Senior Fellow and former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense at the U.S. Department of Defense. Thank you for joining us. Next in the series, we will assess the prospects for the United States cybersecurity, a really critical topic, and we hope that you will join us then. Thank you and goodbye.